everybody. This is Mike with the Mountain Weekly News. Welcome back to episode number 30 of the Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. This week's podcast is being brought to you by Spark R&D. Spark R&D is the manufacturer of the best, most reliable splitboard bindings on the market. Head over to their website, sparkrnd.com. This week's podcast guest is Clark Fiennes. Clark Fiennes is a guide as well as a producer, surfer, skier, a little bit of everything. You've probably heard of Clark before, or you've seen him in the background of Jeremy Jones movies. He was one of his head guides, as well as some of Travis Rice's films. Clark was there for most of that. It's a little bit longer than some of our other interviews because Clark and I had so much to talk about. Got a bunch of stuff happening with Vail Resorts, some gear, and much more. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 30 of the Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. First up in resort news, the two missing snowboarders that went missing in November in Mount Baker, God, they had so much snow back then, their bodies were just found. Oh my gosh, that's almost a year later. They ended up in a very remote, rugged part of the backcountry surrounding Mount Baker. So obviously they got turned around and headed the wrong direction. At least the family will have I don't even know what to say. But anyway, the bodies were found. Vail Resorts. Ooh, this is really important for anybody that is skiing or riding at Vail Resort Mountains. Vail Resorts ski season passes sales for 2018-2019 are up 25%. If you thought Vail Mountains were busy, Vail Resort Mountains were busy in the past, there's an extra 25% people that just bought season passes for this year. Now, obviously, with all the new pass deals, this is kind of to be expected, to be determined how that does affect your local ski hill. Vail Resorts also announced that they are down $85 million in Q4 of 2018. Part of that has to do with Vail Resorts purchasing Stevens Pass Ski Resort, as well as Crested Butte, Mount Okemo, and I think there was a third in there. Their real estate was down about $14 million. So this is what happens when ski resorts or ski companies start getting involved with real estate. That definitely changes their revenue stream and income. Here in Teton County Search and Rescue came out with some stats over the last 10 years. Out of all of the rescues that they do, 84% are male and only 16% are female. This is something we've known for a while, especially in the avalanche community. We like to joke that if you want to stay safe and you don't want to die in avalanches, ski with a woman or ride with a woman. This is very true. There's only been a few times in my life that somebody's questioned the lines I was on or asked me to back off, and each of those times was with a woman. So don't be afraid to speak up. Somehow women are a little bit better about that. Gear news. Well, Spark R&D, our sponsor for this week. Spark R&D puts solar panels up in their headquarters in Bozeman, Montana, where their factory and R&D is located. They get about 188 sunny days a year, so Spark's going to be able to offset 25% of their energy just by using these solar panels. How cool is that? I think anybody that lives in the Mountain West, anywhere that there's sun, you should definitely consider solar. That's the future, and for some reason, I guess due to big business, solar has not been on our radar, but it is back. Sunglasses. Oh my gosh. I've been using these Costa Del Mar sunglasses. This is the first time I've ever had Costa Del Mar sunglasses. You know, in the past, I think they were geared a little bit more toward fishermen, but now they're making a big push into the outdoor space. I tested these Rincon sunglasses. Honestly, over the summer and especially this fall, the lenses and the crispness was just incredible. The contrast that I saw between the leaves and the trees and these just stunning sunsets. These things are only $200. Go check out these sunglasses, the Costa Rincon sunglasses. I got the kind with the copper silver mirror. Again, that's the copper silver mirror. That one really seemed to work well for the mountains. I mean, my new favorite glasses. The only hiccup is I managed to break them pretty quickly, and that was my own fault. I didn't use the case that they provided. So if you're going to buy nice sunglasses like that, use the case. Don't be bummed if you break them. All right, well, this interview with Clark is pretty long, so we're just going to cut into that. Again, thanks for tuning in. This is episode number 30 of the Everything Snowboarding and More podcast.
Cool. I guess I want to start with, you know, most of our readers are going to know about some of the projects you've worked on, like Art of Flight, the fourth phase. What's been your role? You know, I guess a lot of people probably know Kurt's name and, you know, Travis Rice, but you kind of fly under the radar. So what have you done on those past projects?
Well, I guess just to give a little quick background, I was, previous to me being a producer, or even working at the level I worked with starting on the Art of Flight, I was a professional helicopter ski guide and mountain guide, kind of focusing on the Seven Summits. And then when they started making the Art of Flight, they, Kurt and Travis got a hold of me up in Alaska. So I guided their first trip up there. And then at the end of that 3-week stint, which was the opening segment in the Art of Flight, they offered me a job full time. They just said, we don't really like your guiding style and we'll love to have you on the team. And so I kind of, retired from Chugach Powder Guides as the head guide there in Alaska, and then went full time with Brain Farm and Travis and Kurt. So that's kind of the background, how I got hooked up with them. And then, so my role initially when Kurt and Travis hired me was just to be the lead guide. Travis was really comfortable with me in the backcountry initially. I think he had had maybe some, I don't want to say bad experiences, but just maybe not the best experiences with some other guides he'd had throughout his career. And then when he met up with me, we both, it seems like we kind of jived. It wasn't necessarily just because I told him yes to everything. I think it was just kind of the opposite. I did challenge him and kind of, you know, and I think he just felt fairly comfortable with me. So they hired me on as a lead guide for the Red Ranger of the film. Kurt initially saw him when he first met me. He's like, oh, you're a producer. I was like, okay, whatever that means. I'm, you know, I'm a guide. That's what I've been doing. But then slowly as the next 2 years developed and evolved, I became a field producer for the film. So for Art of Flight specifically, you know, as a lead guide for all the safety coordination, all the helis, all that sort of stuff, the rescue, and then also doing kind of just the role as the field producer. And then since then, you know, cut my teeth even further and further and produced a couple other movies with Red Bull Media House. I don't know if that exactly answers your question or not.
Oh, yeah, of course. And you know, doing the different roles, was that kind of hard to put on a different hat to go into more of the producer role when, you know, you've obviously taken all your avalanche courses and you're a guide and you're looking out for the people? How did that differ to kind of go on to more of the producer side?
I mean, you know, honestly, it's not that I don't want to underplay like the role of a producer in the film world, but compared to doing it as a guide, you know, like a guide out there kind of like catering for your clients or your athletes, depending on what you're working on. It wasn't that hard, to be honest, because it's super complicated as a guide. You got to, you know, coordinate athletes, especially when you're working on a film group. You know, you have to worry about permitting. You have to worry about athletes. You have to worry about timing, cameras, audio, so many different elements. The only thing I kind of started to have to do, honestly, was start to learn a little bit about the production world as far as releases. So whether that's an appearance release or a location release, or specific filming permits, not just kind of like running helicopters in an area, you have to have a permit, but actually being able to film. So the transition was actually pretty easy. I just needed to learn a couple extra things. Yeah, I would say it wasn't that hard of a transition. Now my job full time is to be a producer. I've kind of advanced into supervising producer, but I still do the same things out. It's my title, but I still kind of do the same things out in the field. And again, that kind of goes from everything from actually being kind of in the trenches with the team and, you know, getting them, you know, into position, whether we're doing a surf movie or a mountain movie or whatever, all the way to, coordinating, managing budgets. I guess that would be the other one, too, would be to managing film budgets. But then again, that was a pretty easy transition for me, only because coming from running my own helicopter operations, I had to manage budgets there too. So just adding kind of learning a little bit about the industry. And then again, kind of adding in some of the line items that had to do specifically with filming and producing.
Do you remember when you first got your first camera?
I do, very specifically. It was an older stepbrother. I believe I was around, I don't remember the exact age, but I'm going to guess 10. It may have been 11, but I'm going to just say 10 years old. It was an old Ricoh SLR film, and I had a 50 millimeter prime, and I had like, I think it was like a 30 to 105 zoom. And yeah, I fell in love with taking pictures right away. I had no formal training whatsoever. I think, you know, he taught me a little bit about you know, light meters and a little bit about the basics for photography. And then when I was, I guess, 14, I went to high school a couple of years early. And so when I was 14, I took a class in high school that was a classic photography class. And again, I am a little older. This predates anything to do with digital or anything. It was purely, you know, all dark rooms in there taught us how to, you know, expose film, how to dodge and burn and all those old school techniques. And then I started shooting for my pictures, just naturally my pictures. I was already going into the mountains a lot and climbing and skiing and stuff. So me and my friends would go into the mountains and take each other, you know, take pictures of each other skiing and climbing. This was way back in like 1992. You know, kind of Warren Miller, I think, was the only thing that was going on at that time. But you know, I have like, you know, again, I have like my pictures in, I have pictures of me and also taking pictures of my friends skiing in our high school yearbook, in addition to climbing and some other things. So, you know, the kind of to sum it up, my, you know, yeah, age 10 was my first camera, and then I very quickly, you know, really, really got drawn into it. And then just to kind of expand a little further on that is, once I started becoming a guide, it was kind of around, you know, maybe the time I was 20-ish or so, is when digital cameras started to become a little bit more prevalent. I mean, I was still in Alaska. When I first went to Alaska, we were still using Polaroid cameras to be able to take out of a helicopter and land on top and then let the little Polaroid film, you know, develop while we were on top of the mountain. And then we can kind of look at it and figure out our route down the face, which is, again, very analog. But then, as soon as the digital world started coming out, I started carrying one little tiny camera with me all the time, whether it was mountain guiding or heli guiding, and always taking pictures. So I kind of just figured, one thing about photography is being a good photographer, but two is actually having access to these spots. And I realized really early in my guiding career that, you know, I was being allowed to go into these amazing environments. And it's really not that hard to take a good picture when you're standing on top of Denali, for instance, or you're standing at the top of a peak in the Chugach or something like that. So the only main difference back in the day was it was one shot per, there was no like 16 frames a second or 10 frames a second. It was one and you hoped that it was good.
For sure. And as a photographer, well, and as a, you know, a ski guide producer, and photographer, what do you carry with you now? Like if you're, you know, maybe just going out free skiing with some friends or something, I mean, do you carry a big DSLR or do you have like a nice point and shoot that you like to put in your pocket?
I'll be honest, I don't carry cameras that much anymore if I'm just free skiing. Mainly, I have to carry so much stuff when I'm guiding or when I'm producing that it really does, you know, it's nice. But to answer the question, I'm a Sony guy now. And so I would generally take one, you know, if it wasn't just for free skiing, but, you know, like I would take out one camera body and then usually a fairly versatile lens. So some kind of a zoom, like, you know, an 18 to 200 or something that you can do, take some wide angle shots, but you can also zoom into 200 if you need to. But yeah, I mean, when I'm producing, I'm carrying a lot of shit. I'm carrying so much stuff because I do everything from photography. I will also shoot motion picture cameras like Reds or specialty cameras. I'll also sit in helicopters a lot and help kind of direct from a sense. Obviously we have directors for films like Kurt, but like when Kurt can't be there, I would kind of just initially start to take his role of sitting in the front seat with the pilot. And you need to kind of not per se a creative director, but more a technical director while you're out in the field. And so that would be, you know, making sure the camp, like managing helicopter time, managing what the next move is, managing what the athletes, what they want to do, what they feel comfortable with. And then, you know, once everything kind of gets going, then obviously I'd be counting in the helicopter moves and all that sort of stuff. And then I obviously try to take as many pictures. A lot of my shots are actually taken from the co-pilot seat. And that's why a lot of them are like pretty dynamic because they're a lot of aerial shots. And again, it's just one of those things that I'm not, you know, telling the helicopter to move for my shot. I'm just shooting passively on the side while we're making the movie. And then hopefully if I get a shot or here, you know, here or there, then it obviously works. But I always hire a primary photographer. You know, that's going to get the prime angle. And then that allows me to kind of shoot secondary angles, which can be a little bit more risky and artsy as opposed to trying to get that master shot.
For sure. How do you think GoPro's role in action sports has changed the industry in the last, you know, 10 years or so?
I think GoPro's changed it. I mean, they definitely have the POV camera. There's a couple different elements, right? Number one is just the POV angle. We pre-GoPro, again, I've been doing this a long time, so I remember strapping a actual film camera, a Super 16, to Chris Davenport's head, and then have to counterbalance it on a helmet on the other side. So he had essentially a helmet that had, I would say, 15 pounds, because it had a camera on one side and a little housing that was bolted to the helmet. And on the other side was a counterweight of, let's say, 7 pounds or so. And then he has his helmet on that's 15. If he would have fallen, he would have snapped his neck coming straight up. So going from that into number one, it's the ease of it. It's super easy, obviously, to throw a GoPro all over the place. And I was kind of doing that. I was working for a GoPro for a while on the side. And so when we get into the athletes, I'd set up GoPros and all these cool angles. So I think just the ease of getting that POV, number one, is actually the POV. And then beyond that is all these other angles. That's actually not a true POV point of view, but just like stick it on a ski. So like for the unrideables, I screwed some GoPros to a ski looking back up at the rider, you know. So that's not really a POV angle, but it allows us to get this angle that's a decent resolution. You know, again, they're not the best resolution. They're rolling shutter, and so they do get that warble effect here and there. So it's very specific on how you can use them. But yeah, I think it's just, you know, it's allowed for us to, you know, I can go out there really quickly and kind of pre-pro and say, okay, I'm going to put cameras here, pre-pro them, and then in the moment, as you know, I can just hurry and go, hey, let's everyone, you know, push play or push record on all the GoPros. If none of them work, no big deal. But then you do get those really special moments. I have to say, like, I find that those moments that if you only get a couple of seconds, they really are some of the best in the movie because they're just so unique. Like, for instance, the fourth phase trap is following Ajak down that one, and he has a hand gimbal. So he's doing a follow cam. But, you know, I don't know if you remember that shot. And he kind of goes over. He almost looks like he's going to run into Ajak, and, you know, they kind of go over like a little bit of kind of a cliff goalie type thing. But I mean, it looks like a video game. It doesn't even look real, you know, when it really look at it. But yeah, kind of sum it up, like GoPro, they've definitely helped get just the most, like, really unique, real artsy and immersive camera angles. That being said, too, you know, the quality, working for Kurt and Morgan back in the day and Brainform, I was always taught that, you know, resolution and quality of shots are the most important. So it's a real fine balance, right? Because then you're getting these, I mean, they're saying they're shooting 4K, but they're not. They're a compressed 4K. And then you get that rolling shutter warble kind of effect. So I personally really try to limit the amount of GoPros that I use. I don't just like to throw them in. I mean, when they first came out, I used to like to throw them everywhere. But as we've gotten a little bit further in, there's other cameras we've kind of built up that you can still get a POV, but you're going to get a much better true raw 4K. You're going to get a global shutter. So, for instance, like Distance Between Dreams was a surf movie I just produced a couple years ago. We didn't have one GoPro shot in that whole movie. Although I wish we did, because it would have been great if we would have at least gotten one on his board looking up at him as he was dropping into Jaws. That would have been cool. But, yeah, I don't know if that kind of sums up. Yeah, just expand it. It made things a lot easier. You know, it's really easy to push a button on a GoPro. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. It doesn't cost you any money. It doesn't cost you – it's like no harm, no foul. But if you do get that – couple seconds of magic that really can come through on the screen and really make the viewers and the audience, you know, get a really different perspective. And it's not like virtual reality, but it's almost that. It gives you this feeling that you're there.
For sure. And I think that, you know, the one thing that we're seeing with GoPro, you know, the footage of people when they get caught in avalanches, that seems like that's really resonating. You know, it's hard to tell people about avalanche awareness. You know, like we can put them in Avi 1, Avi 2, Avi 3. But when they see those videos and those POVs of somebody getting dug out, that seems to really let people know. You know, the problem is some of the videos, you know, we see the guys getting rad, but like I started this conversation off with you, we rarely see the guys behind the scenes, you know, the guys, the film crew, the production, you know, the EMTs, just all these people. You know, if somebody's looking to get into this kind of riding, the backcountry stuff that they see everybody doing, you know, what do you think is a good first step for getting into the backcountry?
I get this question a lot from either people reaching out to me or friends that I work with, and it's a tough one. I think that I'm a pretty kind of strict person when it comes to it, just because I have been through kind of the grittiest and the gnarliest of when things do go wrong. So I take it super seriously, and I try to always remind people of that, right? Like, you know, like, it's all fun and games until that one thing goes wrong. And when that one thing goes wrong, it really does go wrong. And if you don't know what to do next, then it really becomes a bummer. You know, if you do, when things go wrong and you do know what to do, then it's not as big of a deal from all the way from in the moment and helping, you know, mitigate the accident that's happened all the way to actually handling it later, because you can kind of develop post-traumatic stress syndrome and things like that if you're in an environment and you aren't prepared, because then you do get this shock sensation. Where I've been around some pretty gnarly events, but they don't really resonate with me too much, because we had a plan. We have safety briefings in the beginning. We practice, we exercise what we preach, all these certain things. And so if something does go wrong, then you can actually debrief with your team, and it's not just kind of like, oh my God, like, what did we do? We had no idea what was going on. It was like, no, this is how it led up to making those mistakes. But, that's my preface, is it is very serious. And I always try to tell people that initially, like, this is not just this fun, like, let's go powder skiing in the backcountry. So the first thing I try to tell people is, obviously, you know, get as much education as you can, but then also realize that you can read every single avalanche book, but until you actually have experience in the mountains and you're out there in the snow and you're living, breathing, and riding in it as much as you can, then, you know, you do need to actually have practical experience as opposed to just kind of like, you know, textbook type stuff. So obviously going and getting an avalanche one or an avalanche awareness is a really good one. There's a book called Snow Sense, S-E-N-S-E. And that's a great awareness book that I usually tell people initially. Go buy that book, read it. Make sure you understand, because it's going to give you the foundational terms, some foundational avalanche one type information. But you can refer back to it as opposed to just like taking a class. And most of the time I'll actually give you that book. So that's the first step. Educate yourself. Get a beacon. Obviously, if you're going to go to the backcountry, I mean, the most important thing to do is search out a mentor. You know, find someone that's in your community that you can, that will allow you to come along with them and that are more experienced than you. And then be completely open to them and listen to them and watch them and see how they act and see how the decisions they make. Hopefully, you know, you'll be, you know, fortunate to find someone like that. And then, you know, that's the best way. I mean, kind of going back to how I did it, I knew I wanted to be a heli guide when I was about 12, 13 years old. So by the time I was 17, I already had my EMT, my Avalanche 1 and Avalanche 2, and got a job on the Pro Patrol in Utah. And then obviously my mentors were the pros, like the snow science, the snow safety director, and so on and so forth. Now, and if you want to be real serious about this, that's the best thing. I always have people say, if I want to follow your footsteps, how would I do this? And I say, go get a job on your local ski patrol. It is absolutely the best training. When I ran heli ski operations, I didn't really care if you had your UIAGM full certification. If you hadn't been on a ski patrol, I didn't care if you had your cert. If you had been on a ski patrol for, you know, a bunch of years and you didn't have your cert, I didn't care about that. Like, because a lot of the ski guiding stuff are guides, to be honest. And again, I know this would always cause a little friction within it. But again, I ran my operations and I just saw the guys that run that when you're a ski patroller, you're out there in the thick of it every single day, whether you want to or not. You're reading the snow every day. You're making a forecast for what the snow is going to do every day. You're following the weather. And then in the meantime, you're taking care of people, you know, busting themselves up all the time. And you actually you're essentially the ambulance driver for the mountain. So, you know, if you come across somebody that split their head open and they have an open skull fracture, or they're not breathing, or break a femur, or all these really aggressive, gnarly things, then it doesn't faze you because it just kind of becomes a part of your practice. So yeah, I know it's kind of a long-winded answer, but it's a hard answer for me because I take it really seriously. It's not just kind of like, oh, go to REI and buy a beacon, do some searching, and then just go out into the backcountry. I think before you even get out into the backcountry, you need to have a basic sense, but like I said, I think for a passive amateur person, kind of backcountry or, you know, weekend warrior type, find a mentor, find somebody that can teach you the ropes initially, and hopefully you can do that. And then if you want to take it to the next level, then go get a job on your ski patrol. I think those are the two best ways.
The ski patrol part's heavy. You know, I personally finished my Avi 3 a couple of years ago, and Most of the guys in the course, well, everybody was a, you know, either a guide or ski patrol. I was kind of the only rec skier. And, you know, when I go out skiing with people, I realize that I have none of the emergency medical stuff. You know, I can probably keep you safe. I can show you where to go, where not to go. But if something shit hits the fan, you know, that medical training seems like it's so important. So yeah, the part about the ski patrol, that's pretty heavy. You know, and I wonder if that's where the pro rec split is happening now in the avalanche courses in the United States, where, you know, the guy that's ski patrol maybe is on a different track than the guy that just wants to go out and ski with, you know, his wife and his kids and stay safe. Have you taken any courses up in Canada, or did you do all your certification here in the United States?
You know, I was, again, showing my age, I was a little before the AMGA really gelled and became an institution. It did exist when I started my career, but it wasn't recognized internationally. They weren't even allowed to give out the UIGM certification at that time. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty ridiculed because it was kind of, it wasn't set up that well, to be honest with you. They've come leaps and bounds since then. And so we were already guiding full time. You know, I was guiding at a professional level for a number of years before this whole kind of American cert or certifications came. So I don't have any certifications. But surprisingly, they allowed me to guide in Canada. They allowed me to guide. I haven't guided like professionally in Europe because they're a little bit more tight there. But initially in Canada, they were like, oh, you have to have your cert. But funny enough, is after I got there and started kind of like interacting with them, they saw my skill set. And then they also looked at my resume and they're like, okay, this guy's not just, you know, he definitely has been around the block. And so I was kind of in that gray area. They never really quite grandfathered any of us in officially, but there's of the age of when I was a guide, still many of them don't have their certs. So I never got mine. I got my, you know, Avalanche 1, 2, and 3, at Alta Ski Resort back in the day. And then I got my, and then since then I did the ISSW, which is International Snow Science Workshop. They do that every other year. I started going to them in 2002 and went every year or every 2 years for about a decade. So, not a lot of, no certs in some sense, but a tremendous amount of experience, and that generally spoke for what I did.
Right. As far as a tool for guiding in the mountains, how do you feel AT or a ski setup compares to a split board these days?
I mean, again, this is, I don't want to sound controversial, but yeah, I've guided a ton of snowboarders, obviously, as you know, some of all the best in the world, you know, per se. When I was the head guide, meaning I actually ran all of Judas Powder Guides. I was the lead guide, number one guide. So it was my operation, it was my responsibility, it was my ship. And if guides wanted to guide on a snowboard, I'll come back around to you a little bit, but about to specifically, you know, traveling back when in skis and snowboards. I would allow guides to snowboard guide after they had guided for me and shown me that they really knew how to do a ski cut, the right place to do a ski cut. That's the most important part and the most dangerous part of guiding on a snowboard, to be honest with you. If it's part of your job, or even for an amateur backcountry user, you should be doing ski cuts. And if you don't know what that is, not you personally, but if a person doesn't know what that is, then they probably shouldn't be back there, number one. But you should be doing ski cuts all the time. I mean, you know, as a guide, we ski cut every single run before we go. I mean, well, not every, but as we're, unless we like, we really get into a cycle where we're like, okay, this is not going to slide. This is locked in. And then you can let people kind of go without ski cuts, but that's a standard practice. And so if you're on a snowboard and you do a snowboard cut, it's dangerous. It's hard. If you're on a hillside, you know, if you're on toe side, then, you know, real quick, there's no way to step off the slab. I can see thousands of times I've done a ski cut and been able to, like, brace at my feet, and I step up on my upper ski, and there the slab goes below me. So that's with your feet strapped in. Now, when you're in the backcountry and you're on your approach, there's no difference, you know. It doesn't matter. If you're just going uphill, actually snowboard, a split board is actually better. There's more surface area. It's shorter. You can go up steeper. You can, you know. They're half, you know, half a dozen, six the other, whatever that saying is. They're more or less the same, I'd say, but it's really once you strap in, that's where there's going to be a massive difference. And then again, like when you get into a rescue scenario, you know, being able to travel with skis, being able to like ski downhill and then glide and push and skate and traverse and all these certain things. I mean, bottom line, I love snowboarding style. My skiing style has kind of adopted the snowboard style, slashing and big fat skis and going and hitting lips and all that sort of stuff. I love the riding of it, but I have to stay as a traditionalist and in a mountain traditional world. I know I sound like an old kind of fuck when I say this, but like skiing, being on skis, they're just more versatile in the backcountry. It's just the fact of the matter, you know, going uphill and getting and traveling around the same, going downhill, kind of the same. But if you're taking it as a professional guide standpoint, you know, like I said, there's a handful of snowboard guides that I wouldn't even ever question them at all because they've also been ski guides before. That's the difference. I know that there are snowboard guides out there that haven't ever been a skier, and I'm sure they're really good. But I'm just a little bit of a partial to skiing, and so, yeah.
I appreciate your honesty on that. You know, we've seen a lot of kind of experienced snowboarders that are wanting to go into the guide path switch over to skiing just because of the things that you had mentioned. Let's switch over to surfing a little bit. Are you going to head back to Jaws for this coming El Nino to do some more filming for Red Bull?
Most likely not. You know, obviously I dove head first into, I mean, I've been a surfer since I was about 20 years old. So it's been about 20 years now. And I did it pretty actively in between all my guiding. So I'm a very avid surfer. I live right on the beach here in Los Angeles. I have a house down in Mexico that I go to a lot. So surfing's kind of become my number one passion as far as recreation. As for my involvement in actually filming or taking pictures, the reason that I was so involved with Jaws and in the channel and flying drones and shooting from the cliff and all that was because of Distance Between Dreams. Now that wrapped, I do have another surf kind of documentary in the mix right now. Yet that isn't in full production. And even when that becomes full production, we won't go back to Jaws because it's a completely different kind of movie. So I'll go back there for sure, but I won't be there shooting or being as active as I was previously.
Or regular? Are you regular foot or goofy?
I'm regular.
And what do you surf on? Longboard, shortboard?
I'm all shortboard. I don't really enjoy longboards. It's kind of the same as like I always kind of tell people. For me, longboarding is kind of like being on a pair of fat powder skis on a groomed run. You can make them work, you know, but like on a shortboard, it's kind of like putting on a pair of like 155 slalom skis. You barely even think, you think about turning and you're going to be on edge, like really fucking railing a turn. And that's how it is surfing. You know, you get on a shortboard. I mean, maybe you surf or not, but I'm a huge shortboarder. I'm looking at my surfboards right now. There's not one that's over 6 foot except for one that's like a 6'10" single fin kind of cruiser, which is for sale. So I'm a shortboarder, and yeah, it's become thankfully my passion. I mean, after you ski so long, and since I, you know, started when I was two, and I was skiing 200 plus days a year for almost 20 years, it like you start, it kind of becomes, I don't want to say burned out, but a little bit, you know, it becomes just kind of like your routine. And even though it can be really fun, exhilaration, surfing's kind of become like how skiing was when I was in like high school. You know, it's like you just want it. You live it, you dream it, you just can't wait, and that's how I'm with surfing. So I feel fortunate to have there be another kind of like discipline out there that gives me that same feeling, because skiing has become, you know, I love it and owe my life to skiing in the mountains, but it has become, you know, a bit of a job.
Of course, you know, I live here in Jackson, Wyoming, and people all the time ask me, you know, what do you do? Are you a skier, are you a surfer, you know, a snowboarder? I say, well, I'm a surfer.
Yeah,
I grew up surfing.
Exactly.
It's something I'll always have in me. And, you know, I live here and I snowboard for a living and I do all this, but every year I'm just looking forward to that surf trip to just get in the water. And, you know, it's one of those things you can check out. And it's so similar. I mean, you being a shortboarder, do you ever consider snowboarding, or have you been snowboarding before?
The only time I've ever snowboarded was on the Art of Flight, and we needed to get some camera gear from the top to the bottom, and for some reason somebody's snowboard was there or something, and so I clipped in it in my ski boots and like rode the snowboard down. But I've never snowboarded. Yeah, I mean, I started skiing when I was 2 years old, and I skied a lot, and I just fucking loved it so much. And I know a lot of your audience are going to love skiing, but I really like it. Was there was like my life, you know, I was growing up and going, you know, just through where you're kind of like, wow, what's life about? And why am I here? And all these things you kind of, when we grow up and you go through, you know, and you're a little grom under the age of 10. And then when you become a teenager and you're in school and you're like, what the fuck is life all about? And it was super clear. I'd been on a chairlift and I was like, this is what life is all about. And it was just like clear as day. So I just, and then I became a guide really, you know, started doing this professionally really, really young. So there was, snowboarding wasn't a thing yet when I started. You know, I was on the snow safety team at Park City in Utah before snowboarding was even allowed there. And that wasn't because, you know, because I was like 1997. So it was up and coming, but
yeah,
it still just wasn't a thing yet and recognized at the level that it obviously is today. I highly respect it. I love it. I don't know. I don't really have a desire to do it. I never have. People always give me all this shit about it because I ride with Travis and Jeremy and all the best of the best. But like, I'm a skier. I love skiing. I like having my feet, even, you know, having my feet strapped down like that and just like feels so awkward to me. Like even surfing, you can still move your feet around. You know, you're standing sideways, but you can really adjust your feet. You know, as you know, being a surfer, you're constantly adjusting your feet going forward or back or side to side and things. And so having that like restriction to me, I'm just not into it. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that I'll never do it. I don't really have like this vendetta of being like, I'm never going to snowboard. It just, you know, I think when it comes down to it is like when I was skiing professionally and guiding professionally at the level I was, like there was no time for me to learn or do anything. So when I was in the mountains, I was getting paid and I had a requirement and an expectation to perform. There was no downtime. And again, as you know, like when you're a pro, like there, you really don't have days off all season. So I didn't have time to do it. And now again, like, you know, I had kids or something, obviously I'd put them on skis and I would ski to teach them. So
of course,
I don't know what it's going to take. I get like, you know, bald face. They try to get me to come up and do kind of like their instructors, like pro, like the riders safety course they do every year in December. And
yep.
They try to get me to come up there and do that. I'm going to try to get there this year to do it, but that might be a time where I can learn how to snowboard. But also, yeah, as you know, the learning curve of snowboarding is that as a ski patroller, I don't know how many times I've taken care of broken wrists and broken collarbones. Mm-hmm. And if I broke my wrist or my collarbone snowboarding, I don't think I'd ever forgive myself. So at the age, I'm turning 40 this year in a couple months here. So I think that I might just pass on the snowboarding unless something really, really comes up that's like a reason that I would do it.
For sure. I guess a couple more things. When you're out traveling, you know, this call originally started, the James Brand Group reached out and, I saw that you were working with them and you've got some gear that you use when you're on your adventures. You know, if you're going on vacation or if you're going out to, a film project, what are a couple of things that typically come with you, outside of, you know, like camera gear?
Let's see. Obviously, my James knife, for sure. That's a given. Let's try to paraphrase this in a proper way. I mean, obviously, all my camera gear, which is quite extensive. I know you can use that as a caveat not to talk about, but I do everything from, you know, take still shots to cinematic, like motion shots. I fly drones, so I usually pack all my drone stuff. And this is either if I'm going on a personal trip, I still do the same stuff. I'm still going to take stuff for time-lapse stuff and the drone and all my camera equipment. And then beyond that, music is another huge part of my life. I play a lot of music. I've been a musician since I was a little boy. I've never done it professionally. I've played in a lot of bands, but I didn't really wanted to. So I'll usually take like a slide guitar or some sort of something to practice while I'm on the road because I love playing so much. And I guess those are kind of the main things. I mean, obviously your clothes and then I always have a little med kit with me. It depends on that. I've for some reason, besides being a professional rescuer, and I've been involved with a lot of that, obviously, but I was kind of not as much anymore, but there was a period of my life for a couple of years, I'd say about 4 years, where somehow, be it that fate always had me around accidents happening as a bystander. So
wow.
There's probably, I could give you six examples off the top of my head right now where I'm just driving in my car or I'm standing there and a massive accident happens. And so I always carry a med, and then again, like I was saying before, is like if you're prepared and you have the knowledge and the tools, then an accident like that doesn't really scare me or faze me. You know, again, I've seen some really gnarly stuff and I've had to help people with some really gnarly stuff. But if I have my rubber gloves and I have a couple little things to make me feel comfortable with, like working on somebody that I don't know. So I've always learned to have a little bit of a med kit. I mean, it's not even a little, it's usually a pretty professional med kit, you know, from everything from like managing bleeding to stabilizing an airway to, you know, doing CPR and all that sort of stuff. So I guess it, you know, sum it up is obviously camera gear, clothes, music. So some sort of like a guitar or a slide guitar or something along those lines, a good speaker, and then a little bit of a safety net, just because again I've kind of been somehow deemed as the angel bystander a lot.
Well, that's heavy, and that's another reason to take, you know, that woofer or, you know, that those first aid courses, because I mean, gosh, you never know. I mean, you're driving and all of a sudden you see something and you want to react.
Yeah, I mean, I did the Heimlich three times last year to just random people that were joking, that were just around me, you know. And so, yeah, and again, I don't know why it happens, but that happened in 2017. I did it three times. And then, you know, my girlfriend, and yeah, I just really encourage anybody out there. They don't have to be a guide or they don't need to be even interested in the backcountry. Going and taking a CPR class is like, I just think everybody should have to do it. And it's such an important thing and it's such an easy thing, but to like learn the Heimlich maneuver, like learn, you know, like my girlfriend, for instance, just a month ago, she was up with her two kids, at like this public swimming pool in Idaho, like a hot springs there just south of Jackson. And some little, you know, 6-year-old kid was a little bit unattended and she found him like floating in the pool, like, you know, really traumatic for her. But as I spoke with her and kind of like debriefed her about it, it's important to do that in those situations, was, you know, the most shocking part, other than seeing like this poor little kid not breathing, was that she had no idea what to do. You know, she didn't know what to do. She didn't know like at all, other than just being like, help, help, help. And then when the, you know, unfortunately when the lifeguard came around, like they panicked and didn't know what to do. And a nurse bystander had to jump in order to actually, you know, mitigate the situation and start to do CPR and so on and so forth. And thankfully the kid was okay and he came back to life and all that great stuff. But again, it really shocked her, being like, holy shit. Like I had no idea. I have two kids. I need to take a CPR class. And so since then she has, and you know, I just encourage everybody, you know, like it's what, like a couple hours, you learn some really simple things. And then again, if you're even going into the backcountry at all, you're exactly there. First effort. I don't think you necessarily need to do a full on like woofer, but like you said, a wilderness first responder, I think it's a 1-day course, isn't it? Like an 8-hour, or maybe that's it's a weekend course, a 2-day course or something. Once you have those skills, like, you know, it changes your whole game and your approach.
Definitely. Well, you know, you've worked with, you know, Warren Miller, TGR, let's see, Matchstick, Brain Farm, Red Bull. What's next for Clark, and how can our listeners kind of follow along with what you're doing, you know, via Instagram or your website? What's the best way to kind of stay in touch with all your adventures?
Yeah, I mean, next, I'm still working, you know, I'm still working with Red Bull full time. I have something on my plate, actually. Can't quite talk about it yet, but it'll be another snow thing, we can't really broadcast anything about it yet. But best way to keep up with me is just my Instagram. Like I'm not a Facebooker, and even on my Instagram, it's not really that much personal stuff. It's mainly about either what I've done or what I'm going to do in the world, for my professional world. So Instagram's the best way. My website, which is clarkfinance.com, that pretty much is just, you know, I feed most of my Instagram to there, but yeah, Instagram or my website. And then also just generally it's going to be 99% of the work I do is with Red Bull. So we have a couple films in production. There are, the ones with Red Bull are a little bit different than what we've been in the past. We're trying to shift a little bit. We've done a lot. We're just trying to shift a little bit of like what we're trying to do. So we'll see how that all happens. And, And then other than that, yeah, I have a couple other personal projects on the side I'm doing.
Well, right on. I appreciate you calling in. You gave us a ton of insight, especially, you know, the avalanche and snow safety stuff and just all the stuff about you traveling around the globe. I mean, it's really helped. The last thing, the Seven Summits, did you actually end up completing skiing the Seven Summits?
No, I didn't ski all of them. I've actually only skied really Denali. You can't really guide all Seven Summits in a year properly. I mean, you can, but I got onto the circuit as a byproduct, in a sense, of my heli skiing was my prime goal. In order to get onto a heli ski team, like group, you know, team or one of the, you know, I decided to go down the route of guiding because it would make me stand out a little bit. So I started guiding Denali initially, and then that helped me. Then I guided Aconcagua, Vincent Massey from Antarctica, Carson's Pyramid. So those four I guided, you know, like Denali, I guided 13 times. I did ski off the top of that. I skied at Mesner Pilar, which was the first time I did ski in 7 years. And I also got the first ascents of the Black Rock Couloirs off of the North Summit. So for actually Seven Summit skiing, Denali is pretty much the one that I've done the most skiing on. Aconcagua, I guided 3 times. And Carson's, I guided twice, but never, those are climbing as opposed to skiing. So.
Sick, man. Are you going to do any surf guiding in the future?
I have gotten a job offer to kind of do some stuff. Again, it's not totally public, but I'm really shifting in my life. I think as I'm hitting this age and I've spent so much time in the mountains and guiding and stuff, and I love it so much, but I tell you, like, I'm definitely shifting into either the second or I guess probably the third trimester. I don't really know of my life. It's been kind of advanced or something or accelerated, but I'm really into art right now. I do a lot of, like, I build with these, you can see, and some of the James brand stuff is building these custom tables, you know, writing and making music, and just kind of doing a bunch of stuff with art. So to be honest, I'm kind of finding myself shift away from kind of the guiding and exploration. I just feel like I've done it so much, and you travel so much. I'm still single being 40, so I mean, I have a girlfriend, but it's still in its infancy of 8 months or 10 months, I guess. But I'm trying to shift my life to be a little bit more domesticated, to be honest with you. Just because after, you know, traveling 11 and a half months of the year since I was 17 years old, it definitely is a lifestyle choice you have to make. And so I'm shifting a little bit, trying to be a little bit more domestic, a little more planted and grounded in one spot. And then also I'm really just like the art passion in me is really coming out a lot. So I'm trying to pay attention to that and develop it a little bit. But we'll see. I've had a couple job offers from some guys that do a bunch of, like, pretty big-time surf exploration, like boat trips and stuff like that. And just because of, like, a lot of that's just logistical and management and coordination and also and reading weather and safety and stuff. So I know all those skill sets quite well. But, again, that would just it sounds super awesome, but it would just take me away from, I think, really where my direction is right now.
So with the James brand, which of the knives do you use on a daily basis, or what are you using most out of this collection?
Well, I mean, honestly, I mean, since I am affiliated with them, thankfully I do have all of them, and so I do have like, every single model of theirs, and I do use it for all the different things. The one I carry in my pocket the most is the Chapter Damascus. I've been a huge Damascus fan even before the James brand reached out to me. And so when I saw that, that they did carry one Damascus blade, that was the one I went with. So that's the one I carry with me all the time. You know, the Elko I have on my keychain, I use that for everyday opening packages and just kind of their everyday use one. And then the Country I actually have at home, I have it on my countertop or in my kitchen. I use it for, like, cheese and the cutlery board and for meats and cheeses and stuff, funny enough. And then the final one, the Folsom, it's a little bit more of a utilitarian knife. So, like, for a lot of my woodworking and kind of, like, craft stuff, I have that one kind of right on my tool bench for that stuff. So each one has its own purpose, kind of serves its own purpose for me. And like I said, I've been a knife guy. Being a guide, I've been a knife guy my whole life. And these have become my favorite knives in the world. They're stylish and they're super durable. And, yeah, they're really great.
Well, right on, Clark. I appreciate it. I'll shoot you an email when the podcast goes live, and then you'll have my contact info. If you're ever out in the Tetons and you got a free day and want to go for a tour, definitely hit me up.
Awesome, dude. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it, and I'll look for that email.
All right. Talk soon. Bye.
All right. Cheers. Bye.
Well, that wraps up episode 30 of the Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to tune in next week. We've got more special guests lined up, all sorts of gear news. And actually, right now I'm looking at snow. It has snowed in the Tetons. The mountains are covered in snow. Winter is here.